This is News in No Time. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, companies selling grief as a tourist attraction, the controversy over the devastation and the bus tours that show it in New Orleans, and six Caribbean nations sign a pact for a new free trade zone that will help them flex their economic muscle in the region. Joining us today to talk about these topics and more from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Republican strategist Tara Settmeyer. From our New York bureau, E.R. Shipp, distinguished professor in journalism, Hofstra University, their School of Communications. There, and George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, joins us from Maryland today. All right, folks, thanks very much. We'll get to all of those topics, but one of the things that we wanted to talk about up front is Time Magazine this week has a cover story on Martin Luther King Jr., and it is an excerpt from the Taylor Branch book. George Curry, let me ask you, as we take a look at this man through the eyes of Taylor Branch, this the third in his trilogy of the civil rights movement, this more than any other book that I have read really gives you a peek inside to the personal side, the man who is Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, yes and no. It's an excellent book. Taylor had won Pulitzer Prize for Part in the Water, earlier book, and Bearing the Cross also won Pulitzer Prize by David Garrow. So it's amazing. Two books on King won the Pulitzer Prize. It does delve into his controversial personal life, but that's not the first time that's out. Of course, that's the sensational part, the extramarital affairs. But Abernathy had written about that before. It's in... David Garrow's earlier book, but it's still something that people will be able to hang their hand on and say, hey, this is duplicity here. Here's Mr. Morality here having extramarital affairs. But I think the difference in this one, in terms of all the things that have been written about before, even one woman, a former Kentucky, I think she's still a state Kentucky retired senator from the state of Kentucky, wrote a book, I Shared the Dream. Of course, she shared more than a dream. But here, it apparently is an account of him telling Coretta about one affair in California, I believe, with a woman who was married, and he told her after she just went through surgery, which really sent David Abernathy's wife, Juanita, over the edge in terms of timing. And so these kinds of things out there, they'll be discussed, and obviously that's the most sensational part.
E.R., what's interesting to me, though, not only do they talk about that, but they also talk about the idea, and again, nothing new, but it's always interesting to see and hear from those who surrounded him, that this ominous feeling of death on the horizon for him.
Yes, the last year of his life was filled with that kind of talk, whether it was in meetings with his staff or whether it was in his sermons at Ebenezer in Atlanta or other churches or when it was in the actual protest movements. What I find interesting in this excerpt is something I discovered actually about 10 years ago during the anniversary. I guess it would have been the 30th anniversary of his death, so that would have been about 98. And I learned then just how abandoned he had been by so many people in that last year of his life. On April 4th, 1967, he gave a sermon at Riverside Church in New York, where he joined together this notion of a civil rights movement that was more global than just local, and it was tied into the anti-war movement. From that point on, he was abandoned by fellow members of the civil rights movement, black and white. Editorial board said he would never have any credibility again, and exactly 1 year later, he was dead.
It's interesting to see and think about the idea of the two iconic figures for black America at that time, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King in their final days. We often forget the idea that they had been ostracized by many who had walked them through many a fight in their day. Tara Settmeyer, what's interesting, too, is to look at the idea of how far ahead of his time King was in that, and E.R. and I were talking about this off mic, the idea that those of us who understand and know the history know that the Poor People's Campaign and the idea of economic justice was something that really he saw as the real movement and the foreshadowing of what had to be taken care of in order for African Americans to move forward. That, juxtaposed to what Reverend Jackson just talked about today, is a fight that still goes on among black people.
Absolutely. And the professor is correct about the Beyond Vietnam speech, which is what the media entitled the April 4th, 1967 sermon he gave in New York. At that time, what people often, the history books don't tell us, is what took place between 1965 and 1968. There seems to be almost a missing period there that we don't really learn about what was going on with Martin Luther King, because he became, in some people's eyes, more radical. He was putting forth issues where, once the Civil Rights Bill was passed, he started to question these laws, saying that anti-discrimination laws were empty unless they were enforced, unless you had economic rights as well. He began to say he believed in redistribution of wealth, and the Poor People's Campaign was a personification of that, where he was trying to go around the country and put together a multiracial army of poor people to come to march on Washington again and challenge Congress until they put together a poor person's Bill of Rights. And there were a lot of folks who didn't agree with that. And he lost the support of the mass media, who once supported him so fervently with his civil rights agenda. But once he made the comments on the Beyond Vietnam speech, where he said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, that began his downfall as far as popularity and support amongst the mass media and mainstream America.
And the irony is we're hearing those very words still today as we have put boots down in Iraq.
Absolutely.
But let's move to a controversy present day, and that is what we are seeing in the city of New Orleans now is a bus tour that takes you to the sites of the disaster, if you will. It will show you the Superdome, the convention center, and then it wheels itself through the neighborhoods and gives you an idea of the catastrophe that happened. It's billed, the three-hour tour, as America's worst catastrophe. E.R. Shipp, there are those who suggest, even residents, who say they like the idea because they feel you can't understand the devastation through watching it on television, that in fact you have to see it to believe it, and they hope it will bring more attention to what many Americans have forgotten. We were heartfelt the days and weeks after, but many people now, as we tend to do, move on. There are others who simply say that you are profiteering from the idea of a catastrophe and a disaster.
I guess I'm closer to the latter. It seems rather macabre that you actually need to get on a bus and ride through this disaster zone and see what's left of what we thought of New Orleans as being. Apparently, $3 or $4 from every bus tour ticket is going to go to some fund. But it seems to me that we have lost something if you cannot, through watching the newscast or reading a newspaper or whatever, empathize with people and take action based on that. I don't understand needing to get on a bus and ride through this horror.
George, the idea of exploitation, some will say, is happening to the city of New Orleans. Others will say in order for them to get back on their feet, bring the tourist dollars back and the like, you've got to live with a little exploitation.
Well, it's a novel approach to tourism, that's for certain. I have mixed feelings about it. I think that the people, I mean, one, it's not something I would do, but there are people who want to do it. I see nothing really wrong with their want to do it if it's heartfelt, they really want to see, and if it motivates people to do something. That's a different approach. But if you're going to go there simply to gawk, then I would oppose it.
Sure.
Well, this doesn't surprise me because we live in a culture where everyone's life is on display. In the era of reality television, people put their lives and reality on display all the time. So there's a certain innate desire within us to look at other people's tragedies or their celebrations, but we want to live vicariously through other people, and a disaster is something that fascinates America, whether it's for the good or for the bad. So it doesn't surprise me that this would become a tourist attraction, similar to what took place after the World Trade Center terrorist attack. Yeah. And folks flocked to New York City.
I'm frankly surprised we haven't seen a reality television program about living with the evacuees and the like.
We
All right,
may.
Let's turn our attention to what is an interesting concept, one that many people say is long in coming. Caribbean leaders this week welcomed a free trade zone designated to allow goods, services, and skilled workers to move easily through the region. Six nations, Jamaica, Barbados, Belize, Guyana, Suriname, and Trinidad and Tobago, have joined together with others supposedly coming on board, Tara. The Caribbean single market economy is what they're moving toward, and they also see it as a collective build of economic muscle. Yet, on a comparison scale, all of these countries are relatively poor in the sense of juxtaposing them with other nations. Do you believe this to be a good idea?
Absolutely. We are a proponent of open markets and free trade, and I know that this administration has been has attempted to open markets in this hemisphere more so because of the economic disparities in the Caribbean, Central America, South America. So this is a good idea. It's a step forward. I think it will work. We need to do something. The Caribbean nations also needed to do something to take care of their own communities as well. Some have said that Haiti and the poorer countries have been left behind and not had the support of their fellow Caribbean nations. And I think opening markets and economic freedom is the step to that. That will translate into jobs. It will translate into more power for the people on the ground in these countries.
And it certainly gives this region more economic, political, and social power when dealing with other nations of the world.
Yeah, we've seen that. I mean, it's not a new thing. Look at what the European nations did when they decided to pool their resources and to speak as one on particular issues. This is starting off as an economic project, but one can imagine that it can go in various directions. Political strength, so they can negotiate better agreements with superpowers. We can think of issues such as the environment. The Caribbean nations can demand more of the United States, the big bad boy in this part of the world. We can see political power, of course. Human rights, maybe the Haitis of the hemisphere will come around because they want to trade with or take the benefits of this new union.
Hey, George, here's the interesting part in all of this to me. This also allows member nations to have access to bilateral free trade agreements with other or within the Caribbean community with the likes of Colombia, Cuba, Costa Rica, and the Dominican Republic, as well as Venezuela. Now, if you bring that as a collective here, then you're really starting to talk about if they could find a way to have a full agreement, then you're really starting to talk about not only economic clout, but political and social power, too.
You're talking about some serious economic clout. And let's not forget, Haiti is not a part of this until they get their politics straight. Mm-hmm. The Bahamas won't join now. Which is the strength of it. They don't want the skilled workers who can move freely among the nations. That's exactly the whole strength of the whole thing, is that, you know, you don't have passport, you have regional passport, and people can travel. So I still think they need to bring the Bahamas in there, but I think it's a good thing.
But, with the idea, if you bring a Venezuela, if you bring the Dominican Republic, and tricky here, if Cuba says, you know what, even if it's just to spite America, we're going to involve ourselves in this, then you really have to take a look at this.
Of course. Venezuela also, by the way. What you're talking about, not only the United States' historic confusion about what to do about Cuba, but you've got oil resources when you're talking about Venezuela. You've got
And we've already seen Venezuela thumb its nose to the United States this year, to a great degree.
By donating oil to some of our poor people in the U.S. So, yes, you are talking about real clout there. Fidel Castro won't be around forever, so this may be a time to look ahead to post-Castro. Such a union could benefit all of these Caribbean countries.
All right, let me get this in very quickly.
Because his brother may be a successor.
Let me get this in very quickly, because we only have about 2 minutes and 30 seconds. I say that to our panelists here. But the Boys Choir of Harlem could, in fact, face eviction. They have been housed in a public school in New York City on Madison Avenue, and now they're said to be being evicted by the city's Department of Education for what the agency describes as a host of financial and managerial improprieties. ER, this is such a sad story, no matter how you look at it.
It is very sad, and it reminds us that some of us dropped the ball a year or more ago when the director of the choir was forced to step aside as a manager and to just be the artistic director. A whole new board was supposed to come in and right all the wrongs, and apparently nobody did that. So the choir may lose the school building as a separate school, but they may be able to use the rehearsal space. So,
Tara, we've talked about this on the program a number of times in a number of different instances, obviously, but when you look at these treasures, particularly treasures of the African-American community, you have to start asking yourself, why are so many of these institutions in financial dire straits when they have been the pride of our community for so long?
I found this story troubling. I grew up in North Jersey, and I grew up going to see the Boys Choir of Harlem. And, you know, what, unfortunately, the irony in this situation is, where are the entertainers, the people in the music industry, the actors who grew up in Harlem that know what an important historical force the Boys Choir of Harlem has been, what a positive influence it's been in Harlem? Where are they? How come they can raise money for Tukey Williams and other questionable issues, but yet when something that hits home, there's an absence. So I would like to see people in the community come in and rescue them. But Dr. Turnbull, what's disturbed me about this story is that he really hasn't taken full responsibility for his role in the $5 million in debt that the Academy Choir is in, and he also the molestation issue that took place a few years ago. He says that the fundraising has been difficult, but since then, but he's fairly responsible for the mishandling of that, and he hasn't
taken
responsibility.
All right, George, you get the last 30 seconds. Dr. Turnbull, the celebrities, would be the person who was heading the choir at this point. Go ahead, George.
The celebrities, black celebrities, same place they were with the Alley Museum in Louisville, absent, AWOL. The only upside of this is former Mayor David Dinkins and Congressman Charlie Rangel said they're going to get involved in this, and I think they'll be able to pull something out, but there are still long-term problems.
Yeah, well, one has to suggest if Charlie Rangel's getting involved, he's still pretty feisty even at his age, so hopefully we'll have a positive outcome. I thank you all. Greatly appreciate it.